Hello, I just want to thank all the speakers, and I want to address the point that was made by the Mr. Lika, that the American Army is never funny. All I can say is I understand that when managing a conflict or producing the aesthetic production of conflict, obviously the American Army is not funny. And I realize that that even though the American Army has been radically critiqued in the intervention, the military action, it was never declared war in Vietnam, is deserving of severe critique. Anyone who has been saved by the American Army will be grateful to them. But the American Army is capable of eliciting humor from the American Army. And I just want to say that I called the Department of Defense when the issue of gays, lesbians, were in the military with Don't Ask, Don't Tell was up for view. And I insisted that I speak to Robert Gates. So I got his voicemail, and he said, this is the voicemail ever. This is the voicemail box of Robert Gay. So I actually wound up lecturing him about something else because I realized that the legislation would go through. But I do think that Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the American military was a mirror of something that occurred in society. I don't know if anyone wants to address that issue, but sometimes the American military is funny.
Intentionally funny?
Robert Gay.
You did it for me. Can I say something about that? I just want to remind people that Don't Ask, Don't Tell has led to the destruction of many lives, but it's not that it was a reflection of what was happening in society. It was a piece of political blackmail against the president at the time, Bill Clinton. And it was the opposite of what he had announced in his campaign. And they backed him up against the wall and said, you didn't fight in the war, motherfucker, and we're going to destroy you unless you step back from this. And that was the best he could come up with. Okay.
Hi. This is a broader question, but what role do you feel violence plays in dissent? What role does violence play in dissent?
You mean diversity of tactics?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to call it that.
What's your answer?
I think it's important to have a diversity of tactics.
You what?
I think it's important to have a diversity of tactics. I just realized the microphone was not on my mouth. But I was wondering if you had anything to say about that.
Did I understand the question? What role does violence have in dissent?
In dissent or dissentive artwork? Or, yeah.
I don't feel it didn't really come up exactly in my presentation, so I don't feel like I can. Does anyone have any response to it?
Please.
No, I'm just trying to, I want to tease out what your question is.
Right.
I think I know what you're saying, that there's been a lot of sort of anti-war talk here, mm-hmm. and you're questioning whether we should always be anti-violent?
Yeah.
Is that the question?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I just think that's such a, you know, it's an incredibly complicated question because of the, in other words, you're asking whether we're pacifists or whether...
No, I guess more no, just... I'm sorry.
No, I was just trying to... yeah, go on.
Well, I was going to say just, I mean, maybe to get your opinion on the fact that society places so much value on pacifism, not necessarily how you feel personally.
Yeah.
No,
I totally take your point. From a psychoanalytic point of view, which is, of course, what I've been talking about today, I would say that even in liberatory struggles that have required violence, such as in South Africa, for example, psychotic tendencies can interfere with even those processes. My talk was not meant to be a pacifist talk, and I think the question of violence in you know, other than kind of the state violence and all of the wars that we're against, is an extremely important question. But I still think that that doesn't, it's not simply that we can say, yes, good violence, bad violence, or something like that, but that it's always going to be subject to, and in some cases interfered with, by psychic motivations. That, so in terms of my talk, that's what I would concentrate on.
It was a little hard for me to tell if you were asking about symbolic violence.
Yeah,
or
also, I mean, it's a really big, broad question. But yeah, I mean, I guess you'd have to first define what violence is.
Yeah.
But if you want to talk about symbolic violence, I'd be glad to hear about that.
If
you wanted to talk about that, about symbolic violence, that'd be great.
It's really difficult, but to do that, that's the subject for a day of conversations itself. Symbolic violence as a public act in relationship to movements often is a tremendous distraction, and it allows media and the state to condemn an entire movement on the basis of smashed windows or other property violence. But I'm still mulling over the question of diversity of tactics, which is where this term resides. There have been artists like Kim Jones and others who have done reprehensible things like blowtorching rats on stage in order to make a point about killing, and how the audience is supposed to say, you know, that's the evilest thing I've ever seen. And he will say, yes, but we actually did this to people. He was an ex-soldier. And I think that this is such a traumatic experience. And this is the question that also came up, though, to a much less violent degree in terms of a different kind of violence in relationship to Renzo Martin's work. What does it mean to symbolically stage an event that you claim not to be psychotically or psychically engaged with in order to make a point about, to expand the frame or to focus on something? I find this really, really difficult. I can't do that. I think I'm more in the camp of let's acknowledge we're all tourists together, which is a different kind of thing, you know. I'm going to say something very absurd, which is so far people who step over that boundary in my mind do not generally include women. I'm waiting for a female to prove me wrong.
Thank you for all these talks. I think it's been a terrific panel. And a Stanford historian has recently been arguing that war over the long durée of history, war, and really we mean meaning state wars, consolidation, has reduced violence over time, and that it's been the kind of. But I think that pointing to the, in a way what you were getting to with the wonderful Arc de Triomphe analysis, that war and peace are different sides of the same coin in this idea of but one of the things is that yes, it may have created more stability, but then, and even with the Freudian analysis, this question of then does all conflict then become something that's a function of police state in terms of violence being policed rather than war being conducted between willing adversaries or equivalent adversaries. And I just wonder, the kind of anxiety, I guess, over this notion of internalizing it almost in a Foucauldian way of in which the state then is able to qualify all violence and action as a police matter rather than something that could actually be a conflict between parties in some other form. I don't know if I framed that in a way that was helpful, but... I mean, I guess you feel with the Arc de Triomphe piece, is it taking on the questions of, I mean, is this entirely kind of personalized notion of dealing with non-war, something that could work around that problem? Sorry, I'll let you answer.
I'm not sure I understand your question. I feel like saying that I think the Arc de Triomphe piece, and I don't know if Christoph would say this himself, but the way I read it in any case, so it's founded on a psychoanalytic notion of the ineradicability of aggression, right? And even though at one point in his book he says something other, which I had to disagree with, but I think once we know it's ineradicable, then we have to think, where does it go, right? If we're going to end war, then what happens to that? You know, it has to go somewhere. The Omega Institution was an attempt to have it go there. But I think what the Arc de Triomphe piece, in its public nature, and it's an encouragement of debate and discussion and agonism, which is conflict, right? This is why I'm answering your question this way. That it, to attempt to make it go into democratic agonism. Does that
does
that speak to what you were asking?
I guess in a way I was trying to think too about the African documentary or pseudo documentary in relationship to your project too. In a sense, it seems like the larger state of something like the IMF and these larger superstructures in which war is kind of in a sense taken off the table as an interstate conflict, enables a perpetuation of constant poverty and struggle and diminution of certain kinds of energies and certain kinds of peoples, because war is now completely off the table or subsumed into larger structures that just allow all kinds of violence and horrible aspects to take place, kind of sub facie, you know.
I'm not sure if that's a question for me, but what's the question then? I agree with your point, but
I'm having a very hard time articulating it. So if it's not there, that's okay.
But okay, but what it does make it's a useful comment, I think, and it allows me to ask a question, to redirect it in a way to Rosalind, which I thought her presentation and her argument. This about the psychological origins in a way of violence that have a relation then to warfare is really interesting in relationship to Wodzicka's project. But I still have a reservation about, first of all, Klein and, you know, the I'm wondering if there's a danger here of naturalizing violence through a kind of psychologism. So that's one issue. And then for me, can we transfer if we agree with Klein's argument, can we transfer the dynamics of aggressivity of infantile aggressivity as an explanatory factor for nation state war or post nation state war or conflict on that level? And I'm wondering, part of what gets left out for me is the fact that maybe war isn't always about aggressivity. Maybe it's about the, you know, accumulation of wealth. Maybe it's about economic inequality. Maybe it's about you know, governments that are operating for financial elites and forwarding the interests of multinational corporations. And it's not about violence in any kind of psychological way, but it's about the financialization of warfare in the age of neoliberalism. So I'm curious, Rosalind, how you would factor those issues into your argument.
Okay, you've asked a number of things. So let's just start with the naturalization problem. I mean, in some way, you could say that Kant attributing war to nature, Fornari attributing it to, you know, emergence of human subjectivity, is just a semantic difference, right? Because it's a universal thing that happens. But I think, you know, there has to be some reason that people aren't so cruel, that for extreme cruelty that sort of survives through different regimes and different times or whatever. I'm not in any way, and I tried in my talk to be clear that I wasn't arguing for any kind of psychic determinism. There are obviously other factors that cause war. Those are the ones that's why I quoted Fornari saying there are the traditionally recognized ones. And he goes through them, you know, economic, ideological, et cetera. So
I haven't read the book, but it sounds fascinating.
I mean, the first time, I've read it several times now, and the first time I read it, as I was saying to Martha, when I read the part about the Omega Institution, I was like, oh, give me a break, you know. But as I reread it, it's more, even that part is more and more interesting. It is a fascinating book. So, you know, I think the charge of naturalization is so hard because, you know, I really believe that there can be a rush to historicize that overlooks things that do actually go beyond particular historical moments and particular historical periods. And Slavoj Zizek wrote about this a long time ago. And so I think that's as worrisome as the rush to universalize. The rush to historicize can be as problematic. In terms of the relevance of the psychoanalytic theory to current kinds of, you know, as you mentioned, the financialization of war. So you're saying that, you know, there's not, violence is not involved.
Possibly. I was just,
yeah.
If we think of it that way.
I really can't answer right now, but I still think there's enough of the old-fashioned violence and cruelty and torture and all of the things that we've been talking about this afternoon to make the psychoanalytic theory still incredibly relevant.
I guess this is kind of directed to Rosalind Deutsch as well. I was really interested in the idea that you talked about that the artist you were discussing was kind of, I guess, like promoting this idea that individuals need to be responsible for violence or for war and kind of check that responsibility rather than, I guess, ignoring it and thus making someone else culpable for mm-hmm. the act. But I guess what I was kind of interested in was whether that as a strategy could kind of be reversed, whether that could be exploited by, say, a government to, I guess, kind of further abject that responsibility from themselves as a body and to make the individuals feel responsible or be responsible for actions they're taking as a collective whole. Like, whether that strategy could kind of...
I mean, a denial of responsibility on the part of the state, let's
mm-hmm.
say.
Like, if you're making the individuals take responsibility for these actions, isn't it kind of, like, falling under this increasingly, like, neoliberal individualistic paradigm where, like, we as individuals are responsible for everything we do and the actions we take?
One of the things that I think is useful about this notion of individual responsibility, which for Fornari was, he was dealing a lot with group psychology as well. I didn't talk about that at all. But so he wanted to take back from either the state or the group, he wanted the individual to take back their investment in either the state or the group. And in theories like Beyond's group theory, the group is psychotic, basically. And so bring it back so that responsibility would be on the table altogether, you know, whereas, with the alienation in the state, responsibility isn't even a question. But see, I think that when the individual takes responsibility in the sense that he's talking about it by withdrawing their investment in the state, saying, you know, you can't have my violence anymore, I think that's a way of understanding protest against war. not something where it just, and that's why I said that this is not separate from collective action, that the notion of individual responsibility, I think, has to be articulated with collective action. But I think that we could interpret it as when you protest the war, you're refusing the state your violence.
Hi, thanks very much. I wanted to ask a question about art history and war, and how, I suppose maybe it's more obvious, how artists have taken responsibility. So following on Fornari's idea about taking responsibility, maybe it's more obvious how artists have taken responsibility, but in terms of art historians taking responsibility for war, I was thinking maybe even in a pedagogical sense, how we sort of teach art history and how it has been framed by war and conflict, and critical theories have tried to grapple with, I mean, the recent issue of October, I think, Rosalind, you had a piece in.
The Occupy issue?
Right.
Yeah.
This sort of, so the sort of more contemporary critical theories, but in terms of teaching in art history, I'm teaching a critical methods class right now, so, and I'm so, sort of aware of how war has influenced actually art history and its developments and, you know, immigrants and artists and how those ideas were sort of actually products of war. So it's a very broad question, but how do you see art historians as taking an individual responsibility for war?
Was that directed to me?
It could be anyone, really.
Go for it.
First of all, let me just say one thing before I say anything about that. That the notion of individual responsibility that I'm talking about is specifically about responsibility for the unconscious, right? Not denying that there is such a thing and that we're bad in it. That's in quotes, of course. It just interests me that you say that about art history being developed in relation to war, because so was psychoanalysis, right? And I think that's very important in terms of how it developed. So I just want to turn the question back to you, actually, and ask you, in what way are you saying that art history has been developed, or art history has developed in a war context? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, maybe just how, I guess, I was struck by when I was trying to teach how a lot of these theories had evolved and developed, and then how war had been sort of just an underlying or embedded theme, or, you know, even conflict. Like, I guess, like, I work a lot on feminism, so talking about the Vietnam War in relation to feminism mm-hmm. seems a much more recurring, or it seems more prevalent now that we're looking back at subjectivities about how sort of feminist subjectivities were formed in relation to war, and that's become a really interesting topical way. And so now we have developed like a psychoanalytic feminist way of talking about war in really interesting ways that we didn't have. So those tools are helping us think about, you know, women in the history of representation or art or whatever, however you want, but... So I guess I'm thinking a little bit about how we understand now kinds of historiographies mm-hmm. in relation to how war has been an underlying role with critics, artists.
Just before I turn it over to Martha, who wants to say something, I just, you know, if the question is how do we incorporate that into our teaching, I just think you just teach it.
Yeah. Do you think it's being taught? Do you think art history is still a discipline which is sort of, it's not being taught enough, like those dialogues and discourses around conflict and those ideas are only sort
probably
of more
current
for us
probably it's not being taught
now.
Enough. Yeah, it's probably not being taught enough.
I had a question for you on your intriguing remark about feminism and war. I just might want to quibble a little bit and say, you know, there are multiple feminisms, but in the so-called second wave, the reason, we could certainly say that art feminism or feminism among women artists had a strong relation to the war, because one of the main and perhaps most vibrant elements of the feminist movement in the U.S. was an offshoot of first the civil rights struggle of black people, and then the anti-war movement itself. So we could actually say that a very large segment of us young women of the day were people who had been either direct participants in or standing at the byline advocates for, and then very strong participants in of the civil rights movement, and then in the African American subsequent struggles, and then participants in the anti-war movement. So it's that historically it's the same women. And I think that may adjust a little bit the thesis, because we've just had the 50th anniversary of Betty Friedan's book, which I guarantee you nobody I knew paid any attention to, because we came from an entirely other milieu, and we were actually the next generation, young women. So I think I would say that I find your thesis very fruitful, but I think it needs to be complexified by resituating feminism, and in particular art feminism, within the context of an anti-war and social inclusion struggle in the U.S.
I think for me, as someone who teaches art history, I find that there's often a tension or a conflict in some way between an attention to war in terms of a contemporary event, in terms of contemporary politics, and some kind of loyalty to art history as a discipline. And I don't think that that exists, at least for me. So I think art history needs to become engaged, at least in the way I teach it. So that would mean looking at sites where art, visual culture, activism come together and potentially really disrupt the boundaries and the clear, discrete identity of art history as a discipline. And it's, in some ways it's loyalty to itself rather than its interest and engagement with larger, the political stakes that are going on in the world today. So, I don't know. That's how I had a question for Emmanuel, though, before we... I'm sensing we need to stop probably soon. But in terms of this new project that you're doing, the Hotel Machine, I'm wondering... I think it's fascinating in terms of focusing on this hotel phenomenon within journalism as a site that creates this machinic perpetuation of or homogenizes media discourse. But I'm wondering if it mistakes this architecture in the war zone as the source or origin of homogenization, if it mistakes that architecture for the real site of homogenization, which is happening in the corporate boardroom, in terms of the mergers of media organizations that ends up producing the kind of repetition of stories and the reduction of diversity within the media.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this will be addressed in the film, but what I find interesting with places or buildings that they're tangible. No, you can touch them. You can, in almost forensic approach, you can make them speak. No, I mean, of course, walls don't speak. I mean, you need to go through, for example, this interface I mentioned, the fixer that will go and talk to people, talk to employees, and also there will be journalists who will be invited back into the hotel. So I agree, it's not the hotel itself. I mean, anyway, it was not built for that purpose. I mean, usually it's built for tourism and places where you would look at the city, and then its function is shifting. But the main interest for me is that, it's an object, and I mean, it's very difficult to touch upon all the corporation decision that you were mentioning, having to deal with a physical place for me is like I mean, anyway, that's something you can film first, and then, you know, it can easily or not refer to what you were mentioning, but it's clearly, otherwise this project can be just told in one sentence, no? Like journalists go in hotels and they live there and they film from there and that's it. I mean, hopefully I will make it a bit more complex and not talking only about roofs and windows and balconies, but also a place where, you know, there are different forces, tensions, and it's all happening there, but not only there. I mean, it's of course it's in a network of much more complex things, of course.
So I'll just have perhaps a question which has to do with proximity and distance, near and close. And I was thinking about Okwi Enwezal's recent show at the Triennale of Paris, which is entitled Intense Proximity. And I was thinking of Martha's work that you did, the first version of, I mean, the anti-Vietnam series that you made, and then going back to it in 2004, 2005, in relation to Iraq. I'm also thinking about Emmanuel and the sense of being able to observe the war, you know, through the hotel, which becomes a machine, not just a hotel in its physicality, but as a machine. And also even Martin's film, where you see the person taking the photograph of the. I mean, you can't be closer than that, right? I mean, he's just there, and you're taking the photograph. And there seems to me to be like a certain, if we're going to speak about war and contemporaneity, the contemporary development of war, and the ways in which artists are also sort of representing and thinking about that war, it seems that what is being grasped even more so is the fact that it is, in a way, closer. It's happening. It's not as distant, if we're going to take the quote that was taken initially with regards to your first series. It seems to be, on the contrary, closer and closer. And what does that mean? Does this proximity mean? And it seems to be crossing a bit some of these. I'm not sure about Wodishko, how he would fit into the distant and the near.
What is closer?
I think the closer would be, and I'm thinking also about this question of violence, and perhaps it's hard to measure violence, sociologists are actually telling us that that the world is becoming, or at least the Western world, is becoming less violent. And but in fact, it's hard to imagine that, because in a way, we have more and more images of violence. There are more and more images of violence which are accessible to us, through
That's
the internet.
That's my husband calling.
Okay, we'll stop at one point.
From China. Okay.
From China.
Yeah.
You see proximity.
That's I'm sorry. I forgot to turn it off.
It's okay. So we have access through either social media, through all the different media that we have, being television, being social media, being the internet. We have access to these wars, at least through our perception of it, through our accessibility of the images. The images are actually made more present to us. There are probably, of course, more secret images circulating about these wars. It's also the case that the war, if we could think of 2001, well, you know, the war was not just out there, it was also within. And so the fact that we, as tourists, we have more and more access to these monuments of war, it just seems to me that they're in that way sort of, it's not that the war is getting closer to us, it's its representations, it's the images about, the images of violence that are circulating and which are becoming increasingly accessible, which was, I don't think, not really the case, I would say, 30 years ago. So it's in that way, and I'm sorry if I wasn't really that.
And yet at the same time, violence is being exercised from a greater and greater distance.
Yes, through the, yeah.
Well, through drones, you know, bombing from the air.
Yeah,
you know, it began with bombing from the air, but now it's, you know, drones. Where, so I wouldn't say that it's, you know, blanketly that it's getting closer.
And it's not everything that's getting closer either, because, I mean, the obvious example is the restriction on showing American bodies of military, you know, soldiers during the recent Iraq war, that was censored in the U.S. media, so that, you know, what gets closer is also pretty strictly controlled. And I think that has, you know, massive political implications in terms of fostering support for the war as it did.
Well, I just want to point out what I sort of said in passing, which is that really it's not though obviously I agree with what you just said as well. And one of the things that our little anti-war group did was we reproduced images of the coffins coming home at Dover Air Force Base on postcards and gave them out en masse to people. So the circulation of types of images and the suppression of others, I think that's very old school, and probably the more neoliberal approach is to contextualize rather than to suppress, which always works better. But the point is not to... I think it's slightly diversionary to talk about the fact that these images are ever-present, because really all this requires is a more sophisticated contextualization, as we can see perhaps with Zero Dark Thirty, where obviously we have a narrative of torture that's reconstituted as a covert argument about women and power and about the good character of the person who winds up being the torturer, because formerly they were Germans, they were Nazis and, you know, evil South Americans. The renegotiation of the frame of the violence and is actually as important as the presentation and circulation of the images, because they never circulate without a text. Nothing ever circulates without a text. But also, I mean, we're familiar with the idea that images that circulate have one text for one group and another for another, which is why, for example, the Murdoch press had to go full frontal against the Occupy, because Occupy, being a new phenomenon in New York and the U.S., pictures and conversations, discussions with people were occurring unmediatedly, in a sense, and simply Murdoch at a certain point decided to call them dirty fucking hippies and to call up stereotypes to explain who these people really were despite what they seemed like, which was your neighbor from across the street and so on. So I would really press very strongly to say that we can't talk about images without talking about their mode and method of circulation in the mass and the way in which mass media, which is both your points, contextualizes and reads them and gives them valence.
Thank you very much. So I think we'll have to stop with these comments. And so first of all, I want to thank, it's really wonderful to actually have an end of the conference where most of the crowd is actually constituted by or with students. I mean, we're always afraid that students, you know, they've lost the culture of conferences. Well, I think it's nice to see that that generation is there. And this is also a testimony to the fact that you are, you know, that you've been really interesting. So thank you very much. I also thank Cheryl Simon and the DHC Art and the Phi Center for really lending us this wonderful space, and so thank you again. Okay.